Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. The vault lies open, and inside the vault this time, I see not just a void, but a planet hanging in the darkness.
The planet Arrakis. Dune itself.
We're going back to our classic Dune episodes. These were some fan favorites back in the day. So there were two episodes on Dune we did. We did an episode about the technology of Dune and an episode about the biology of Dune back in September and October of 2015. So this is going to be the first episode of our Dune revival. This one originally aired on September 29th, 2015, and it was called The Science of Dune Technology.
Right. One of the main focuses in this episode is going to be the stillsuit. These are, of course, the water reclamation suits that you see in the movie adaptations and, of course, appears in the original 1965 book by Frank Herbert as well.
Right. Robert, are you ready for another Dune movie, or are you just pretty satisfied with with what exists now?
I am satisfied with what we have now, but I am all in on a new vision, a new cinematic vision of the Dune universe.
Listeners out there, I've got homework for you. If you've never seen David Lynch's Dune, or if you have seen it, either way, you should go watch David Lynch's Dune and just take notes on all the scenes that have a pug in them.
There is a pug, a royal pug.
I don't think the pug was in the book. I don't remember anything about a pug.
No.
Maybe in the sequels? Are there pug sequels?
They should do one. They should have like the pugs of House Atreides. That would be a wonderful focus for one of the prequel novels.
But in David Lynch's movie, there is totally a pug in several scenes. Like sometimes he's sitting in Kyle MacLachlan's lap. Sometimes Captain Picard is about to run into battle on the planet Arrakis, and he's just got a pug in his arms, Dune pug.
Yeah, it's just one of the many wonderful visual features of that film. An imperfect adaptation, but I am not the sort of Dune fan that can completely hate upon the 1984 film adaptation.
I will kill him.
Yes. All right. Well, it's a long episode, so without further ado, let us enter the vault.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, This is Edric, your guild navigator speaking, just letting you know that we've begun our approach to our minimal safe departure for our one-way jaunt to the planet Arrakis. This is, of course, just a precaution, as the Spacing Guild currently holds an impeccable record of Holtzman-enabled space fabric distortion travel. And as always, you can rest assured that no thinking machine has taken your lives into its care, but rather the prescient melange augmented powers of the human mind. So sit back, enjoy our in-flight presentation of Maud Beam conversations, and our flight attendants will check in with you shortly.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And I want to thank musician Raleigh Porter for that bit of music there. That's The Laxu off his 2011 album Aftertime, released by Subtext Recording. And you'll find a link on the landing page for this episode to learn more about that work. But as the title of this episode and our intro narration presents, we're of course talking about the Dune universe in this week's episodes.
So you've probably heard us talking about Dune on recent episodes of the show. I've mentioned several times that I've been reading it. I finally finished reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved this book.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through my reread of it. I think this will be the third time I've read it. And it's a book that has a special place in my heart as well.
It's very strange to me that a book written 50 years ago, that's one of the reasons we're doing this, is mm-hmm. that this year in 2015, it's the 50th anniversary of the publication of Dune, that a book this old can feel so fresh and imaginative. So much science fiction is disturbingly familiar when you go to it. I don't know. When I went into the world of Dune, I was constantly surprised by what I encountered.
Yeah, it's so unlike anything that had come before it, and unlike, even though it's had a huge impact on the genre, there's nothing quite like it to this day. I mean, it's you have this space age feudalistic society, mm-hmm. and it's full of you have prophets, you have fabulous creatures, you have strange science, strange technology that's changing the shape of life.
Yeah, so to describe the influencer in terms of the influenced, a young person approaching Dune today might want to think of it as sort of like Game of Thrones in space.
Yeah, except, there's a lot of political intrigue.
Yeah, but also with a lot of philosophical commentary. And I have to say, this is the most ecological novel I've ever read. I've never read anything as concerned with ecology and the conservation of resources.
Yeah, a tremendous amount of thought went into the creation of this alien ecosystem, an alien ecosystem that is not only intrinsically interesting, but plays an enormously important role in the plot.
Right. So we're going to do two episodes about the science of Dune, talking about the world imagined by Frank Herbert in his novel Dune and in the larger Dune universe, but then also real-world parallels to this science and how Dune has influenced science fiction.
Yeah, so we're going to be discussing some of the science fiction, some of the actual science, but one of the reasons that the sci-fi aspects of Frank Herbert's Dune continues to resonate so well is, first of all, it's set a tremendously long period of time in the future, and he does a great job about giving you some details, but leaving a lot of the details a bit ambiguous and unexplained, and you're just sort of left to fill in the blanks in your own mind.
Right, and if you know how sci-fi fans work, they will fill in those blanks.
Yes, so two of our primary resources here are, first of all, a fabulous new publication titled The Science of Dune, edited by Kevin R. Grazier, Ph.D. It's an unauthorized exploration into the real science behind Frank Herbert's fictional universe, and it's a series of essays, all by experts in their field, planetologists, cosmologists, etc. It's a fabulous book. We'll have a link to where you can pick up a copy on the landing page for this episode. We also dug in a little bit into the Dune Encyclopedia, which came out in 1985. It's long out of print, but there are used copies out there available for purchase. And this was compiled by Dr. Willis E. McNelly. And this also involved a number of different freelance writers and some scientists weighing in on not only the science, potential science underlying the details of Herbert's universe, but also some of just the cultural aspects as well.
Right. It's got recipes for Fremen flatbread.
Yes. I was, you pointed that out yesterday, and I was very fascinated by the topic. There are also lyrics to songs. There's, as well as some science into how, say, you know, sandworms or face dancers may have worked.
Yeah. You know, thinking about the recipe for Fremen flatbread, I wonder why the Fremen would cook anything, because cooking is almost always the cause of much evaporation and loss of moisture.
Well, perhaps they have a special oven, like a still oven, that captures all that moisture.
Yeah, so they seal off the kitchen and no moisture can escape, and then you can cook.
Yeah, indeed.
That makes sense.
Now, I also just want to preface here, too, that we're dealing primarily with the 1965 novel Dune, with some discussion of details that may pop up in Frank Herbert's later novels. We don't really get into any of the more recent works by Brian Herbert. Brian Herbert is, of course, the son of Frank Herbert, and he continued the saga, did some prequels and a number of Legends of Dune books with his collaborator. But I have personally not read them. I know a lot of people enjoy them, so we would love to hear from anyone who has read those books, who has additional information they want to share based on their enjoyment of that sort of continued universe.
Right, but these two episodes we're doing are going to be primarily the first novel, Dune, and then our wonderful supplementary materials.
Yeah, the kind of stuff that I think for the most part people, even who haven't read the book, might be familiar with from either the David Lynch film adaptation.
Oh, and we got to talk about that.
Oh, yeah. The Sci-Fi Channel miniseries from several years back, or just sort of the general cultural resonance of the series. And we're going to try and make sure it's not too deep, so if you have little or no understanding of the Dune universe, we'll hold your hand through the sands.
So we mentioned it's going to be a two-part episode. This first episode today is going to be about primarily the technology of the Dune universe. And then the next episode we do, we're going to try to focus on the organic components, the biology and the ecology of the Dune universe. But before we get into the meat of today's episode, I think we should just give a very, very brief cursory plot synopsis to people who haven't read the book, but want to be able to have a basic idea of what's going on. So what happens in the novel Dune?
Well, essentially you have a space opera in which you have a galactic civilization spread across various planets, right?
Right, and there is one precious key resource in the universe that everybody wants and sort of controls all trade, and that resource is the spice melange. It comes from one planet in the entire universe, and that planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
Yeah, it's the stuff that really makes ultimately travel between planets possible. It makes the interplanetary economy possible. So everything is hinging on this one precious commodity. It's essentially the oil of the Dune universe.
Right. And you can't get it anywhere else. So the characters that come in on the story, there are two main houses in the story. There's House Atreides and there's House Harkonnen.
Mm-hmm.
The Atreides are, it's kind of Manichaean, I guess. The Atreides are the good guys and the Harkonnens are very, very bad guys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Harkonnens are a product of the environment too, to a certain extent. But yeah, they're pretty villainous.
Yeah. And they are essentially competing for control of the planet that produces spice. And there's a lot of warfare and backstabbing and treachery and double crossing and tests of loyalty. But ultimately, the main thrust of the story is the adventure of Paul Atreides, the young son of House Atreides, and his mother Jessica, while they're learning how to live on the planet Dune and eventually participating in a journey of cosmic discovery and revenge.
Yeah, and drugs. Like, yeah. At the heart, it's such a quintessential, like, 1960s product, right? Because it's about a young man who takes an hallucinogen and then saves the galaxy.
You know, I never thought of it that way, but that's pretty much right. We'll get way more into the drugs in the second episode, but today we wanted to talk about the technological theater of the Dune universe. And I think one of the coolest concepts that's created in the book that Frank Herbert comes up with is the idea that this is a future scenario without computers or robots.
Right. Yeah, it is a post-Butlerian jihad world. So basically imagine the singularity has occurred. We have thinking machines everywhere that are caring for us, looking after us. I tend to interpret it more as like the beneficial aspects of a post-singularity world in which your computers are not like, you know, enslaving you and making you work in their salt mines, but they've just become such a ubiquitous aspect of our lives. And eventually humans rebel against that.
Yeah. So there is, in the past of this universe, a great war against the machines. And it's referred to, as you said, by the name the Butlerian Jihad, from the name Butler. Butlerian Jihad. And I like the idea that it invokes the concept of jihad. So it's not just like in the Terminator movies,
right,
where there is a war for survival against the machines, or maybe like you might find in The Matrix or something like that. The machines take over, they decide they want to kill us or enslave us, and we fight back. There is that element, I think, mm-hmm, but there is also a deeper, more spiritual element, which is where the concept of the jihad comes in. It's a physical struggle, but it's also a spiritual struggle for the soul of humankind.
Yeah, indeed. Like some of Frank Herbert himself didn't really give you a lot of details on it. He left it, you know, like a lot of the details in the Dune universe, a little ambiguous, and you were left to sort of dwell on the philosophical implications. But just a few quotes from the fictional tomes, such as the Orange Catholic Bible, that play a prominent role in the universe. Thou shalt not create a machine in the likeness of a human mind. Thou shalt not disfigure the soul. And then this is a great line from some of the appendix material in the 65 novel. Then came the Butlerian Jihad, two generations of chaos. The god of machine logic was overthrown among the masses, and a new concept raised. Man may not be replaced. I've been thinking a lot about this just in my daily life, you know, about even with like thinking machines, but just the use of Facebook in your daily life, you know, the use of social media, the use of all these gadgets. And so for me, when I think of this Butlerian Jihad, it seems as much a rebellion against that as it is against, you know, some robot with a laser gun.
Sure, and it's not unusual for our technology to change us, mm-hmm, right? I mean, it doesn't just make our lives easier. It changes the way we prioritize things and the way we go about our lives. One way of looking at this might be something like agriculture. I mean, mm-hmm, that's a technology that I think a lot of people would argue fundamentally changed the human animal. Homo sapiens is not the same anymore after we invented agriculture.
Right.
And you could probably look at the rise of thinking machines, of computers, in perhaps the same way. It is changing us in a very fundamental way. I mean, who knows what that will look like 10,000 years in the future as the Dune universe imagines. But it's doing something to our brains when we can have vast computational power, vast power of storage of information, and as imagined by this sort of singularity future, decision-making power.
Yeah.
That we can outsource to machines.
Yeah, just think of all the things we outsource already, all the things we no longer bother to remember because mm-hmm, the machine remembers it for us.
So yeah, like you said, your interpretation of this coming in, I agree with this about the Butlerian Jihad, it having something to do with the way humans are changed by our dependence on machines.
Mm-hmm. So either way, we end up with a situation in these books, in this world, where we've kicked out the computers. The humans won. But now the humans have to do all the things that the machines were doing beforehand. So what do you do when suddenly, you know, just think about a business. So you can't depend on accounting software anymore. What do? You have to turn to the human mind to deal with all that accounting. What do you do when it comes to navigational concerns? I mean, even in our own lives, we become dependent on these, things like Google Maps and Waze, right, to tell us how to get from point A to point B.
Sure.
If we throw that out the window, suddenly we have to look at maps. Suddenly we have to know which way is north and south. It falls to the human to know how to navigate.
Yeah, and it gets even tougher, of course, when you're in space.
Right. So without the aid of advanced computer computation, they have to turn to human capabilities. And they have to essentially breed and train special classes of humans to take on these varying taxing tasks.
Right. And so some of these classes that you encounter in the Dune universe, well, one of them, the most straightforward upgrading of the human mind to replace computers would be the Mentats.
Yes.
There are several characters in the book who are explained to be Mentats, and this is pretty straightforwardly a human computer.
Right.
It's a person whose mind has been trained and I think in some ways stimulated by drugs.
Yeah, they're constantly consuming some variation of some wine type elixir to sort of supercharge them. It's kind of like a Red Bull.
Yeah, it talks about their purple stained lips.
Yeah.
And these Mentats really do in some ways fulfill the function of computers. In other ways, they're sort of like advisors. They're sort of the perfect computer-human hybrid. They can do computation. They can store vast amounts of information. They seem to pretty much remember everything, like that they do not ever forget any details.
Right.
Or at least as far as I can tell from the first novel. But then also they are attuned to human nuance. It's something that's not true of the computers today. They might be more a replacement for the kind of, you know, superhuman artificial intelligence that we imagine in the post-singularity world.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that they have kind of an ethical guideline to them. And if you want one that's twisted, you have to – essentially, it's like a jailbroken iPhone.
Yeah. I want to order a sociopathic Mentat.
Yeah, in that case, you have to go to the Tleilaxu, and they will provide you with one. And, of course, one of them is a major character in the early goings of the novel.
Yeah, that's true.
And then, of course, there's the Spacing Guild. These are the individuals who handle interplanetary travel. And this is a very complex, dangerous arrangement. So you have guild navigators, individuals who have been specially bred, trained, and to varying degrees engineered to make the kind of advanced navigational computations necessary to get from planet A to planet B without just popping out of existence.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned that the Mentats rely on some kind of drug that stains their lips purple. The guild navigators definitely rely on a drug, and that drug is the drug we talked about at the opening, spice. And
yes.
We'll go more into the spice and the effects of spice in the second episode, but it's a key part of their outlook, of their abilities, is not just this computational power, but also sort of the ability to see the future, which spice gives them.
Yeah, at least a very limited amount, just so you can see where your various choices will take you. And you can, at least in the next few seconds, avoid the ones that will destroy you.
Yeah.
And therefore sort of feel your way through the dark safely from point A to point B.
Yeah, and then there's a third group of these sort of advanced humans that I think is maybe the most interesting of the three and also the hardest to pin down and define, but they're the Bene Gesserit.
Yes.
So the main character of the novel, Paul Atreides, his mother is Jessica, and she's a Bene Gesserit-trained woman. The Bene Gesserit are a female order of super smart, very perceptive, highly trained priestesses of some kind who have an aptitude for politics, for one thing. Mm-hmm. Like they are tuned into all the finer points of human expression that we miss every day. They're sort of human lie detectors. They can tell what people are thinking and what they're going to do by micro expressions on their faces, tonal shifts in their voices, and that they command a sort of supreme knowledge of the human animal and how it works.
Yeah, and they play a fascinating long game, too, of manipulating mythology, mnemonics, and culture to their benefit.
Yeah, one of the most interesting examples of this that comes up in the novel is the idea of called the Missionaria Protectiva?
Yes, yeah.
Which is this fascinating idea that this order goes throughout the galaxy seeding planets with mythology that later members of the order can rely upon if they're in a pinch.
Yeah.
So it's as if you went to every city in the country you live in, spreading rumors about, I don't know, prophecies about someone who would come to your community and save it from poverty and everything. And then you tell all your friends exactly what to do to fulfill those prophecies.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fabulous fail-safe, and also they're laying the grounds for future manipulation. And of course, at their heart, they also have a breeding program.
Yeah, which has some, I think, some creepy similarities to eugenics programs.
Yeah, indeed. There's definitely a eugenic vibe to it. They're trying to breed a specific person, what they call the Kwisatz Haderach, a term signifying one who can be many places at once.
I thought the translation of that term was the shortening of the way.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I believe that is also invoked as well. But according to the Dune Appendix, in simpler terms, what they saw it is, quote, a human with mental powers permitting him to understand and use higher order dimensions. So they're essentially trying to breed a super mentat, a human supercomputer with prescient abilities found in the Guild Navigators, but without necessarily having to imbue the spice.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a sense, they're trying to get to that next phase of evolution in terms of human thinking, the human thinking apparatus.
I don't think you can make evolution happen. You just got to wait on it.
they're determined, though. And then on top of that, you have the Bene Thilaxu, who have continued to refine human form and function, often in ways that push the envelope of acceptability. So in this, you see that, you know, that post-human conundrum. Like, how much can you change a human and it still be a human?
Yeah, I love this aspect of the universe, that it's so fresh and interesting that they imagine a future without robots and computers, because robots and computers, of course, are ubiquitous and in science fiction. And I think a lot of times with good reason, because it certainly does seem to be the trend in human history, is outsourcing all of our capabilities to machines that can do them better.
Right.
Or at least do them cheaper, or, I don't know, at greater scale. But here we have human technology. It is really the wetware future universe, where all of the things that computers used to do, or even that, you know, they can't do for us today, but we only imagine they could do, are all replaced by human perfection.
Yeah. You know, and it all makes me think, too, of our episodes on techno-religion, right? It's particularly some of the conundrums of how do I create a refrigerator that will operate in keeping with the laws of the Sabbath, right?
Yeah.
You're having to advance your technology, but do so within certain religious frameworks and religious guidelines.
Right. Oh, yeah, because we don't want to lose sight of that. It is dictated in the Orange Catholic Bible. And it's not just that people sort of frown on computers. The Bible says you shall not do it.
Right. It's blasphemy to do this sort of thing. So you have to work around it.
Yeah. So the sort of upgraded, advanced human brain technology is a larger feature of the Dune universe. And if we want to try to relate that to real technology, I can't see that there's all that much we could say about it, except that, of course, people can – there are some people with exceptional mental abilities. People can hone their skills in certain areas. But I don't know if there's a wine you can drink that will make you a mentat, and I'm doubtful we will ever discover such a thing, because I tend to assume that the human mind is already operating probably at pretty close to its capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy into this whole, like, you know, we only use 10% of our brains.
No, yeah, yeah, that you tend to throw that out the window. When you start looking at, like, what makes an individual a genius, you know, it's not just in nature, but it's also nurture. There are several different factors. And granted, I'm sure the manipulations of the Bene Gesserit would involve both nature and nurture, but still.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if we do want to isolate specific capabilities of these people, say the capability of the Bene Gesserit to read micro expressions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that very well could be trained in a person. And then other things like the ability of a mentat to recall vast amounts of information beyond what would normally be accessible to the average human's memory. I think you could compare that to what the really good people, the memory athletes, do. You know, like we talked about in the Memory Palace episode, people make these memory palaces. Like, how exactly does that work?
Oh, that's, of course, just using a different type of memory and invoking spatial memory to memorize, say, a list of terms or a table of information.
Yeah. So if you have a list of 500 numbers that you could never remember, well, what if you imagine those numbers as objects that are kind of strange, oriented in a room that you're familiar with? Some people can use methods like this to recall things that we would never normally recall.
Yeah. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. But anyway, that's sort of the human technology in the broader universe of Dune. I think we should now zero in on the planet Dune itself, the planet Arrakis, because the physical conditions on the surface of this planet constitute a huge part of the struggle of this book. A lot of the plot is just based around the fact that this is a desert planet, water is extremely scarce, people are constantly fighting to stay alive and preserve moisture in a place where every single drop of water wants to evaporate and disappear.
Yeah, it's like an extremely harsh life, and it requires some rather ingenious cultural innovations, but also technological innovations.
Yeah, and I think one of the most interesting pieces of technology we encounter in the book Dune is the stillsuits. So what are the stillsuits?
All right, so stillsuit, and this is something I imagine people are definitely familiar with from the movies, and again, may just be familiar with outside of having ever seen or read anything Dune-related, but it's a second skin worn by the desert-inhabiting Fremen of Arrakis, and it traps body moisture and recycles it through tubes, cooling the wearer and also preventing water loss. So it collects your sweat, your urine, moisture from your fecal matter, and then coils it around you, cools you down a bit, and then you drink it out of a little straw in your mouthpiece.
Yeah, so if you've seen pictures of Kyle MacLachlan with little things dangling out of his nose in the desert,
mm-hmm.
that's probably from the movie Dune, unless he did another movie with stuff hanging out of his nose in the desert. That's from the movie Dune, and he's wearing at least the David Lynch version of what the still suit looks like. The Fremen you mentioned these are sort of the native inhabitants of the planet Arrakis. These are the people who are perfectly adapted over many generations to life in this extremely harsh desert condition. Yeah, and the Fremen, they take their still suit discipline very seriously. They don't waste any water. They keep their still suits on unless they're in a sealed off place that can retain moisture. And it sounds like a rough life, but it's also very interesting as described in the novel because, of course, what happens to you in the desert without a still suit?
Well, you die. And we're told that if you're out there unprotected in the desert, you can't last a full day unless you have just a massive amount of water on hand.
It just burns you right out.
Right. But if you have a Fremen still suit, a proper Fremen still suit, not one of those city models, you can actually limit your water loss to 15 milliliters a day. And so yeah, it's an invention of necessity by these Fremen who were former nomads. Says
they were Zen Sunni nomads.
Yeah, Zen Sunni nomads who popped around from planet to planet, evidently picking up different technologies and material technology along the way, which they then implement in designing the suit.
Yeah, and so there's a scientist character in the novel Dune named Kynes, Liet Kynes, who explains how the stillsuits work.
Yeah, and again, this is another example of Herbert giving us some details, perhaps in this case a few too many details, as we'll get into, but leaving a lot of the nitty-gritty stuff to the reader to figure out. So Kynes tells us that a stillsuit is a micro sandwich, quote, a high efficiency filter and heat exchange system. So you have a layer that touches the skin that's porous, and perspiration passes through it, and it cools the body in a manner that maintains the existing cooling process of the bodies, which we'll get into. That's key and problematic. And then you have two additional layers on the suit that include heat exchange filaments and salt precipitators, the latter of which is used to reclaim salt. Now, why do we call it a still suit? What does that mean? It's just like a moonshine still,
right? A distillery.
Yeah. You're separating, which is, all about separating different liquids.
Yeah.
The still up in the, Appalachian Mountains, that's all about separating alcohol, but with the still suit, it's about separating, potable water, from salt, and other waste materials in a wearer's excretions.
Now, what I immediately wonder when I encounter this concept is, okay, that sounds very interesting. I wonder if something like that could be done in real life. But one of the main questions is, where does it get its energy from? Like, how is this distillation process powered? Because if you think of a still, you've got to boil things. You've got to be feeding energy into the system to power the distillation process. What's going on in the still suit?
Well, according to Kynes, and ultimately according to Frank Herbert here, it's all due to body movement, especially breathing, and then this and some osmotic action that's providing the pumping force for all of this water. And again, as we'll get into, that there are a lot of questions surrounding how that would actually work.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, once the water gets distilled, it gets filtered into these things that they talk about in the novel called catch pockets,
mm-hmm.
which is great because then you've just got a little straw and you can just suck the water straight out of your suit when you're thirsty.
Yeah. Yeah, and
used to be your pee, now it's tasty desert water.
Yeah, the urine and feces are processed in your thigh pads, which is a detail I remember kind of sticking on when I read this for the first time, like back in junior high or high school.
Yeah, they just mentioned that so briefly.
Yeah, because it also it makes you feel like you're probably constantly aware of the poop cakes
uh-huh.
that are stored in the thighs of your pants.
I'm like, Frank, tell me more about the feces.
Yeah,
I've got to know.
Like, does it? We were talking about this the other day. Like, does it? Like, I was kind of imagining it's kind of like cleaning out the filter on your dryer, except every so often a Fremen has to stop and remove this flat cake of like super dry poop.
Yeah, I imagined it for some reason as a powder.
Okay, I think that would make sense too.
Yeah, if you've removed all of the liquid from it, I guess it could pretty easily be disintegrated into a powder. You can just sort of dust out the back of your suit.
Yeah, I could see that working. Yeah, just drop your poop powder.
Then again, if it's a powder, you might easily inhale it. I don't know. Speaking of breathing, that's another way your body loses moisture, right? Every time you exhale, you're wasting some precious water vapor. It's going straight out your nose.
That's right. And that's why on the still suit, you breathe in through a mouth filter and you breathe out through the nose. And then you have that little nostril tube that's supposedly reclaiming moisture from your exhalation.
And that's pretty much it, right? I mean, Herbert doesn't give us all that much detail on exactly how the still suit works, despite how important it is in the novel.
That's right. So we have to turn to expert commentators to figure out exactly how it might work and how it maybe doesn't work based on our current technological understanding.
Okay. Is there, should we go first to the Dune Encyclopedia or the Science of Dune?
I think we're going to go to the Science of Dune first because I think this has the most robust explanation. And then the Dune Encyclopedia potentially fills in some gaps.
So the stillsuit article wasn't by the editor Grazier, but was by a different guy, right?
Yes. NASA engineer John C. Smith wrote this one. And tackles the topic at some length in the piece Stillsuit. He points out that we've seen a lot of stillsuit patents over the decades since the release of Dune, but they all kind of muck up the thermodynamics. And the thermodynamics are really one of the sticking points here. Ultimately, he maintains that if you take a strict literal interpretation of Herbert's writing, the stillsuit, quote, probably would not work and most likely would cook the wearer like a crock pot. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And yet we can certainly envision technological advancements that would make a stillsuit possible in the future. And since we're talking about a sci-fi realm 13,000 years in the future, that's certainly time enough for various technologies and especially metamaterials to come online to enable it.
Right. Well, maybe we should look at this one energy loss source at a time.
Okay.
So let's think about sweat first. Sweat does something really important. It cools you. This might not always be the case if you live in a very moist environment where it's hard for the sweat to evaporate. But if you're in a place like Arrakis, if you're in a desert environment, a dry environment, and you're sweating, that evaporation is bringing your temperature down.
Right. I mean, it's even taking place on just a very ambient level. Failure to sweat leads to heat stroke and death. And as Smith points out in his piece here, the golden gal in Goldfinger, you might remember, she's painted gold and then she dies. It's often, they're saying, oh, she suffocated. But in reality, he says she would have probably died from heat stroke.
I feel like I've heard a lot of disputes about whether that person who's got the full body paint job would survive or not. I think I've read people saying that wouldn't actually kill you.
Yeah, I think I've seen people go back and forth on that as well. All of us missing probably the point that they just wanted to put a dead, naked golden lady on the screen there.
Yeah.
But either way, if you enclose the entire body in a sealed suit like this, you're courting death in the form of heat stroke.
Yeah.
And that's one of the primary design flaws with a still suit. Even when inactive, the body has to dissipate about 90 watts of heat just to balance out the heat of your metabolism.
Yeah.
So like, even if you're not, whoo, I'm sweaty, sweat is still an important process. Most of the body heat arises from the liver, the brain, heart, and muscles, and it's dissipated through blood circulation at the skin level, along with the primary method of sweating. So even when passive, sweat glands excrete 0.6 kilograms of perspiration per day, maximum rate 1.5 liters per hour. And it's also worth noting, you see images of people throwing the hood back on that still suit, but
right,
the hood is essential.
Movie.
Yeah, in the movie. The hood is essential because your Ekran sweat glands are all over the body, but they have the highest concentration in the forehead. And the Ekran sweat glands, those are the ones that are tied exclusively to cooling, not to be confused with any that have hormonal issues.
Yeah, so you said that John C. Smith mentions that there are patents out for stillsuits. I tried to find an example of a stillsuit in the wild. I was looking around on the internet to see if anybody had made one. I didn't find one. I did find a Gizmodo article from July 2013 proclaiming in the headline, quote, The sweat-to-water purifier, real-life Dune stillsuit will save lives. Unfortunately, this was interesting, but it turned out to be kind of an exaggeration. So it referred back to a BBC article about this inventor named Andreas Hammer, who he invented a device called the sweat machine, which was designed to reclaim and distill water from sweaty clothing through a process known as membrane distillation. And essentially, the machine spins clothing in a centrifuge to pull all the liquids out. So if you have a high efficiency washing machine, that it does the same thing, though maybe not to the same level of extraction as the centrifuge. But the idea is that a high efficiency washing machine spins the wet clothes really fast to drain out all of the moisture, and then the clothes spend less time in the energy gobbling dryer. But in the sweat machine, instead of the washer water, it's pulling out some salty, nasty sweat, and then it distills that liquid by heating it and then circulating it between two membranes. And basically the way the membranes work is that the membranes are hot on the sweaty side and cool on the other side. And this creates a vapor pressure differential that pulls water and only water, so not all of the other molecules, just the H2O molecules, through the membrane and leaves all the other stuff on the other side. So they say that one sweaty T-shirt typically contains roughly 10 milliliters or about 0.3 ounces, which is about a mouthful of water.
Okay. So this is
Your sweaty T-shirt is a sip.
Okay. So it's a body water reclamation technology.
Yeah.
But not something that you could actually use in a suit.
No, unfortunately. So you can drink it. They say it's cleaner than tap water. And they cited one example of when they served the product of this machine to a bunch of people in the public at this event called the Gothia Cup in Gothenburg, Sweden. I looked it up. That's like a football/soccer tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, but looking at the setup of the machine, I can't really see how this could be incorporated into a feasible bodysuit. It's pretty big, especially given the necessity of the centrifuge process to extract the liquid in the beginning. Like, you couldn't have the machine be part of a suit if it needs to extract the liquid from the suit.
Right.
So I don't really begrudge them a cool headline referring to a still suit, but the comparison doesn't really seem apt to me. But it is an interesting invention nonetheless. And of course, sweat is not the only way the body wastes precious moisture, as if H2O were just cheap and abundant.
Yeah, as we mentioned already, you got to take into account urine. It's 95% water. The rest is metabolic waste, salts, organic materials. You can drink a little of it and feel okay, and some people even claim therapeutic benefits, but it's ultimately like cutting your kidneys out of the waste removal process if you just keep guzzling urine. So you have to take the waste out. And, of course, this is also a very real area of waste processing technology.
Sure, yeah. Reclaiming water from urine is something that happens in space all the time, for example. So shipping water to space is really expensive. We talked about the costs of getting cargo into orbit before. It's hard to put an exact figure on the cost per pound to low Earth orbit today, but traditionally a round estimate they used to give was $10,000 per pound. We don't know how much it costs today, but it's expensive. And you know that great feeling you get when you've just been doing strenuous exercise and then you sit down and drink a whole glass of water at once? Astronauts on the ISS have to exercise all the time mitigate the effects of bone and muscle density loss that you experience in microgravity. So without reclamation efforts, that refreshing glass of water you get right after an hour on the treadmill is going to – that might be a $10,000 glass of water. Who knows? So instead of constantly shipping up new water, the crew members on the ISS rely on it's called the Environmental Control and Life Support System, or the ECLSS. And that has within it water reclamation systems. So when the astronauts exhale some hot, moist breath on each other, the habitat can recycle and reclaim it. When the astronauts pee or spit in the sink during oral hygiene routines, the station can capture that water. In a Space.com article I read about this, the author Denise Chow said that without the recycling system, an average of roughly 10,000 pounds of water per crew member would be required from Earth each year to keep the station properly functioning.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of – being in space is kind of like being on Arrakis. Like, you know, it's mighty precious. You got to hang on to it. And so there have been a lot of efforts at research for reclaiming water for space missions. Early space missions like the Apollo missions came up with solutions like electrolytic silver ion generators. And apparently these could disinfect drinking water. They would like remove bacteria from the water without having to dump a bunch of bleach or other chemicals in there. And then today the ISS uses a more complex filtration system that's got three steps. It's basically got a filter step that gets out particles and junk from the liquid. And then they push it through a semi-permeable membrane, that has these substances in it that pull out organic materials. And then finally they have a catalytic oxidation reactor, and that kills bacteria and takes all the other organic compounds out of it. But of course, that's at the space station level. It's still not a suit.
Right.
Could you shrink it down to the individual level? Sort of, but not exactly. So, NASA scientists have equipped at least some astronauts headed for the ISS with test demonstrations of personal-sized water purification bags that don't drain energy like the large-scale recycling systems, but instead depend on this process known as forward osmosis. Generally, this concept is called the forward osmosis bag, or FOB, F-O-B.
The FOB.
Yeah, and so forward osmosis takes place when you've got two liquid solutions separated by another one of these semi-permeable membranes. One of the liquid solutions has a lower concentration. This is probably going to be your dirty water. Mm-hmm. And then one has a higher concentration, and that's this electrolyte-filled solution, which I think is like Gatorade or something, pretty much along those lines. And then the water flows naturally from the lower concentration solution to the higher. And the semi-permeability of the membrane means that it allows water molecules to pass through, but not larger molecules or objects like bacteria and proteins. From what I can tell, NASA's still investigating how well and under what conditions these devices work. I read a Wired report in 2011 that said that they hadn't been able at that time to prevent urea, which is a waste product that you find in urine, from getting through in the osmosis bag. But apparently a Japanese TV crew member decided to try some of the product of the forward osmosis bag despite that warning. And he said it tasted like Capri Sun.
Ah.
So there's your free ad for Capri Sun. A more recent work I found it's a NASA research report from 2015 that mentioned the fact that these osmosis powered devices work slower in microgravity, and they're testing ways of solving that problem. But okay, so sweat, urine, kind of gross, but at least basically liquid. Are we ready to talk about feces?
Well, we are in the podcast, but the larger concern is that we're really not as a civilization. Feces is of course 75% water. The rest is undigested food and bacteria, but there's water in there, water that is ideally worth reclaiming. But we've actually seen far fewer studies regarding fecal water reclamation, though. The thing is, of course, this takes place, as does urine, water reclamation, sweat reclamation, whatever, via the natural water cycle on the planet itself.
Sure.
Now, in his essay, Smith points to a University of Colorado study on water recycling for a Mars mission that found that reclaimed water would be minimal from feces, and that they'd also have to factor in, quote, psychological concerns, unquote, for the crew. And so in this we get back to the psychological contagion inherent in any water reclamation effort. And I mean, I've blogged about this in the past. You have to be able to wrap your mind around the fact that the water you're drinking used to be urine or used to be part of poop, when really, I mean, you can essentially say any water you drink was, you know, may have been poop at some point in the past.
Oh,
may have been dinosaur urine.
It almost
urine,
certainly
right?
was,
yeah.
right?
But yeah, you have to deal with, you know, how is the user end of that experience working out? And it's interesting because it could be done, and we just haven't faced a dire enough circumstance, despite the fact that we're talking about a trip to Mars here. Interestingly enough, in the book Packing for Mars by Mary Roach, she mentions that NASA scientists at one point, they actually pondered recycling fecal matter into food, but they never pursued it at all just because of that ick factor. And part of this, as she lays out, you have at the time, you know, especially early on in the space program, you have the very sort of cowboy mentality of the, you know, the ex-test pilots who are becoming astronauts, the explorers. And then you have the scientists. And the scientists are more inclined to present some out there notions, such as, what if you could eat portions of the spaceship? That was another idea that came up. Eating, what if the insulation itself was food? Or, you know, making small cakes out of poop. And of course, the astronauts themselves were not going to go for that idea on any level, again, due to the psychological contagion inherent in fecal water reclamation.
That's so gross, I gotta admit. I mean, it's one of those things where I wonder if there's an equivalent to the Mentat, the Bene Gesserit, the Guild Navigator, the person who has upgraded their mental faculties to escape the ick factor. It's an ickless human, the person who eats poop with no qualms.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess, again, it just comes down to, are you in a dire enough condition? And Arrakis is that environment.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Now, Smith, coming back to sweating itself, though, Smith has a real problem with the idea that the suit would allow your normal sweat process to carry on. Because as we'll discuss, it's not just a matter of water leaving your body and ooh, now you're cool. you need an evaporation to take place. And he doubts that, quote, near normal evaporation process would even be possible in a still suit. For organic cooling to take place, sweat must go through a phase change from a liquid to vapor in order to remove heat and cool the skin. So it's an endothermic process. And moving sweat away, just wicking it away, as with specially designed workout garments, that just merely makes your skin drier, not cooler. That's why so-called wicking fabrics, which use a passive capillary action to move sweat from your skin to the outer surface of your workout garment, they help you stay warm during cold weather workouts. You're interfering in the natural cooling process, not at 100% level, because it's not skin tight, not completely, but it's still preventing sweat from doing what it does. And I think anybody who's ever worn a scuba suit outside of the water in the sun for any amount of time can probably attest to that. You can overheat really quickly in that environment because it's making such close contact with the skin.
When I was watching the David Lynch Dune movie, I was looking at those actors and thinking like, wow, that looks really hot.
Yeah, I mean, apparently these were thin latex bodysuits. And of course, they were not functional still suits. So they were having to deal with overheating, falling out from the heat. And interestingly enough, Patrick Stewart has apparently gone on record saying it's the least comfortable thing he ever wore for any kind of a film or TV project. And this is from the guy who had to wear that awful Starfleet uniform.
Uh-huh.
I was not aware of this, but apparently they call it the Picard maneuver. If you watch it enough, you'll see that he's always tugging down on the garment to keep it from riding up. So anyway, the bottom line here is that the skin level layer of the stillsuit would need to be a highly thermally conductive layer that allowed evaporating cooling to take place. Again, perhaps via some as yet uninvented metamaterial. And yet, even then, the humidity in the skin level porous layer would need to be high humidity, which could, in theory, merely just escalate the whole situation. More perspiration, more heat. And according to John C. Smith, the suit would have to self-dehumidify as well. So, and in order for all that water vapor to become liquid again, so that you could drink it, you'd have to have condensation occur. And for this phase change to happen, which is an exothermic process, you need to have a cooled layer, such as, a cold glass on a hot day, and you see that, the moisture form
right.
on it. And there's no mention of refrigeration in the suit, but it would be necessary, as far as we understand the process, for that phase shift to happen.
Man, that just sounds like a mess.
Yeah, that's the thing. It seems like it would be if you don't have a clear understanding of how sweat works and how cooling works and indeed how cooling systems work, it seems like it would be a simpler mechanism, but it's not.
Yeah, now of course refrigeration does exist, so perhaps it's just a question of how much bulk do you want to incorporate into your suit?
Yeah, I mean, can you fit some manner of heat pump in there, a Freon compressor? We have firefighters that use like blue ice packs near the skin to keep their body from overheating, but would that make sense at all in a water scarce environment? And then you also have to, any of these systems would also involve more power. And all we have to go on is that it's powered by motions of the body, especially breathing. And according to Smith here, that would not be sufficient to power the suit given our current progress on motion generated power. Even if we augmented it with solar power, which again is iffy because you want to travel by night
right.
On Arrakis. You just end up again not being able to keep up with the energy requirements for the suit. So that's what Smith has to say. More recent commentary, but if we look to the Dune Encyclopedia and the entry written by Christine Watson, she stresses the use of still cloth based on the principles of a cryogenic separator that's, she says, used on a number of worlds to draw oxygen and other gases from the planet's atmosphere. So here we see a futuristic metamaterial explanation. And as for cooling, she says that the tubes contained air at the beginning of the suit cycle, the air pressure built up by the pumping action of the wearer's breathing and by heel pumps. At a preset pressure, the air was released into a holding chamber in the suit's hood. This sudden release cooled the air by the Joule-Thompson effect, and the cooled air was drawn back into the system and again through the suit, dropping the temperature of the separating layers. And that Joule-Thompson effect, by the way, that's the temperature exchange of a gas or liquid when it is forced through a valve or porous plug while kept insulated so that no heat is exchanged with the environment.
I got to be honest. I didn't follow that.
I had to go at it a couple of times, but basically it comes down to the fact that the hood would be kind of an essential air bladder for the suit's cooling system. So imagine the still suit. Imagine Kyle MacLachlan in the still suit, but with kind of a ballooned hood portion.
Man, that makes Muad'Dib a little less cool looking if he's got a balloon head.
Yeah, I would think so. So again, you have to kind of talk it up to say, however the still suit works, it evidently involves some materials and technologies that we haven't quite figured out in this ancient day and age.
Yeah.
Now, another interesting technology that you see on Arrakis and also elsewhere in the worlds of Dune, the use of ornithopters, of aircraft that fly via flapping wings.
Yeah, so we are told that the power of House Atreides on their home planet of Caladan before they move to the desert planet of Arrakis is air power. They're an air force power, kind of like you might think of the United States on the sort of military geopolitical world stage. The power is concentrated in the ability to strike from above.
Mm-hmm.
But their way of striking from above is not much like anything we would commonly use on Earth technology today. It is like something we would commonly see in the biological world. So, of course, birds fly by flapping their wings. Insects fly by flapping their wings. It seems like a perfectly normal way to get around. But there's a reason our airplanes don't do this. Ornithopters can be built. You can make a machine that stays in the air by flapping wings, but it is not a very practical way to move heavy cargo or passengers.
That's right. And certainly that's what you see utilized in the Dune universe, like swooping down to pick up a mobile spice factory off of the sands before a worm can get to it. Yeah, according to Dr. James Usherwood of the University of London's RVC Structure and Motion Laboratory, this is one area of design where nature doesn't quite nail it. And this is kind of ironic because in the field of biomimicry, we see in a lot of cases we can turn to nature and say, well, how did nature evolve to solve this design problem? And oftentimes they have a really elegant – nature has a really elegant solution.
I'd say that's especially true on the very small scale. Mm-hmm. Biomimicry becomes more and more powerful the smaller you go.
Yeah. In an essay titled A Flying and Walking, Learning from Nature, and this was published in the book 70 Great Mysteries of the Natural World, which I highly recommend, Usherwood points out that a slow-flying pigeon requires up to 4 times the power an equivalent helicopter would need. And hovering is even worse, resulting in pitiful amounts of lift for the amount of energy exerted. Each pump of the wings requires yet another burst of energy, and it all adds up pretty quickly. That's why hummingbirds have the highest energy expenditure of any warm-blooded animal, 10 times that of a human. They're perpetually on the verge of starvation, and sometimes have to actually go into kind of suspended animation to deal with these energy costs, and all the time, consuming colossal amounts of nectar to keep up.
They're little sugar water vampires.
Yeah.
They cannot be sated.
Yeah, so, looking back, you see early aviation pioneers who toyed around with flapping wings, generally with disastrous results. But you do see scientists that have been looking into its use for micro-air vehicles, or MAVs. And these are tiny robotic aircraft that depend on biomechanical flight designs. And the funding typically comes into play, for obvious surveillance purposes, right? Some sort of tiny robot with buzzing, flapping wings that you can use to spy on somebody.
Now, what is the appeal of that over just like a tiny quad rotor drone or something like that? Is it just that it would look like an insect?
I think so. And I think also there is that biomimicry attraction, saying if it's flight at a small scale, then perhaps there is an advantage in drawing on real-world comparisons.
But overall, we are not going to see passenger planes with flapping wings.
No. And I was looking at a U.S. Army Research Office report from 2005 that was weighing in and saying that when it comes to MAVs, you're looking at enormous manufacturing challenges, inefficient energy usage, and dependence on less understood small-scale physics. So at this point in time, even small ornithopters seem out of reach.
Yeah. Now, if you want to just cheat and invoke some science fiction magic, you might say that the ornithopters have something to do with other technology present in the Dune universe, like suspensors. I noticed you put in a note here, right?
Yeah, yeah. And this draws us right into another important technology that we're going to spend less time on because there are fewer answers, and that is the Holtzman effect that enables faster-than-light travel. It enables personal shields. It enables just ubiquitous use of anti-gravity suspensors that – I mean, you know, the main character, one of the main characters, Vladimir Harkonnen, uses it to float around and suspend his bulk. But yeah. You also see mentions of just, you know, oh, here's a suspensor-enabled chair in a room.
If you watch any scene from the movie and not the whole movie, not the whole David Lynch movie, go watch the scene where Vladimir Harkonnen floats up and screams, "I will have the spice." That's pretty good. But anyway, I thought this is also a really cool technology as imagined in the books, specifically with application to the shields. Now, there are personal energy shields imagined in the Dune universe, and you've probably seen all kinds of science fiction that has shields. You know, mm-hmm. Shields up, you know, you put them up around the spaceship and they deflect incoming weaponry, projectiles, energy beams. But these are personal shields that are often imagined. Well, actually, there are large scale shields and there are personal shields, but you might click a button on your belt and suddenly a shield comes up around your body. Somebody tries to run and stab you with a knife, they'll be deflected by the shield. And so the solution to this creates a very interesting combat dynamic that people talk about in the book where people engaging in knife fights with shields activated have to come up with ways of trying to move their knife very slowly mm-hmm. toward the enemy because a quickly incoming knife will be deflected by the shield. But if you can stab ever so slowly, you can go through the shield gently and then you can penetrate the person's skin and make them bleed.
Yeah, so the defensive technology requires a different style of martial arts. So we don't know a lot about the Holtzman effect in the books. It's described as the negative repelling effect of a shield generator, and a suspensor is the secondary low drain phase of the Holtzman field generator, and it nullifies gravity within certain limits prescribed by relative mass and energy consumption. So in this, we have no choice but to turn to the science of Dune and the writings there of planetary scientist Kevin R. Grazier, who also edited, and he also worked with physicist Jess Seeger on some of this. And as they point out, much of the whole Holtzman situation is unexplained. In the later books, we do learn that Guild Highliners, the big spaceships, travel the stars by the, quote, compression or warping of space-time in conjunction with mass neutralization. And as planetary scientist, again, Kevin R. Grazier points out, in Cosmic Origami, that's the piece in The Science of Dune, if the mass of a spaceship could be nullified, then the relativistic effects of high-speed space travel could be reduced. So essentially it's talking about, all right, if you could simply dampen or nullify the mass of an object, then that would enable you to cheat in various respects in terms of acceleration in space-time. Also, Grazier and Seeger posit that the Holtzman field is an energy screening shield. Perhaps it screens the mass of an object from the rest of the universe. Lowering the mass of an object would also lower the force of gravity on it, lower it enough, and you just float around up in the air. And as for space travel, theory and observations of general relativity indicate that space-time can be curved and warped, and perhaps it can even be folded and compressed. So again, the classic example is you have a map, right, and you fold the map and then you just poke a hole through point A and point B and now you have the hole, right?
Right. The tesseract.
Yeah, there you go. The tesseract example, the event horizon example. You thus shorten the distance between two points, meaning that faster than light acceleration and all the problems therein might not even be necessary. In the Dune books, we don't know much more beyond that other than the process is dangerous and costly. You really need a number-crunching power of an advanced computer to handle it all, but in the Dune universe, it all falls to human minds enhanced by spice.
All right, so that's pretty out there science fiction. I think I'd have to say the same thing about the energy shields as yeah. that relates to the Holtzman effect. I can't think of any example, and I wasn't able to find any example of a real energy shield in the world that would successfully deflect incoming matter like that, especially not without harming the person who is wearing it. I mean, you could imagine wearing a huge magnet of some kind.
Yeah.
That, you know, if somebody tries to shoot a bullet at you or something like that, might be able to deflect it if it's powerful enough. But I mean, at certain points, you're getting into levels of energy that make the proposition ridiculous. And so if you're imagining an energy shield like they have, maybe the closest thing I've seen would be propositions of energy shields, like ion shields around spaceships to prevent incoming radiation. But I don't even know if that's really viable.
Okay. Yeah, it's definitely less down to earth compared to the stillsuit. So there you have it. Some of the technology of Dune. Not all of it by any means. We just decided to draw on a few examples that we could discuss here in the podcast. And again, we're going to do a second episode and we'll get into the biology of Dune a bit, where we're definitely going to discuss sandworms in detail. So as we lead out here, we're going to enjoy another track from Raleigh Porter. This is Ix, again, off the 2011 album Aftertime, released by Subtext Recordings. There's a link on the landing page, but you can learn more about his work at RaleighPorter.com. In the meantime, check out StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That is the mothership. That's where you will find all of our podcasts, videos, and blog posts, as well as links out to our social media accounts.
And if you want to get in touch with us about your favorite fact about the Dune universe or any feedback about these episodes, you can email us at BlowTheMind@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.